Welcome back to His Time on Worldwide KFUO. It's time for our daily lectionary study, looking at the text that we oratioed, that we prayed earlier in order to meditatio, study it more deeply now, rally distinguished law and gospel, and get deep and find the goods. And I'll tell you what, if this next 40 minutes can compare to the last 3 minutes conversation I just had with Dr. David Lewis of Concordia Seminary St. Louis, we're in for a real treat. Everything from Tiamat to the abyss and beyond. Just hold on to your hats. We'll get there, God willing. If you got a question or comment about the text, please give us a ring, 1-800-730-2727, or you can tweet me at Rev Fisk. I love getting the questions there and trying to hit them. Although again, there's so much today because we not only have Jesus calming the storm, we got him dealing with this demoniac of the Gerasenes. A common enough story. We did it a little while back in Mark. But now we got some different edges to it here. Get a look at how Luke does things differently. Dr. Lewis, good morning. And again, just real quick, tell people again what the exegetical department that you serve at the seminary is like. And maybe, you know, what are things like right now, given the call day just happened? People are, like, done studying?
Well, that's always the temptation.
That's right.
Last Wednesday, all of our students were looking for calls were placed.
Oh, that's
In
great.
Fact, there are 69 churches, about 60 to 69 churches that put out calls that didn't get calls.
Okay.
With both seminaries.
Well, that's that shortage we've been talking about
for
a while.
Yeah, that is. So if you know anybody out there who you think should consider serving as a pastor, any of you pastors, any of you lay people, any fathers or mothers who have sons, you might put it in their mind now that it is a high calling to be one who proclaims the gospel and administers the sacraments to God's people.
And the exegetical department helps prepare you for that
our area specialty is the interpretation of the Word of God. And I find it, I've been a Bible student my whole life, even as soon as I could read, as soon as I had a Bible. And I do find it amazing that I actually get paid to do what I would love to do anyway.
Right.
It's an awesome call and an awesome responsibility. And yeah, post-call day, you know, at least the fourth year guys, some of them, I haven't seen any bad attitudes yet, but they're getting short. They know where they're going. They're contacting their congregations. It's an exciting time, I would say. More so, I'm kind of with them, you know, like,
right.
I'm teaching John of the Catholic Epistles right now, and our last days we're going to cover the book of James, First and Second Peter, and Revelation, a day for each.
Yeah.
And I think those are interesting books,
yeah,
to keep their interest, but they got to get their final projects in today so
okay.
I can
get them graded.
Get them graded, and they know that they can participate in commencement, which is now it's hard to believe. That's 1, 2, 3 Fridays from
yeah,
today.
Coming up
so,
quick.
Yeah, it's coming up quick. So yeah.
Once the rain stops.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's not raining today.
But it's raining in our text.
Yes, it is.
Hey, yeah. I love it when the segues happen. That
there
was
is
great.
A squall of wind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, context-wise, anything that you would want to bring to bear in terms of the stories that have led to this point?
Well, we've seen Jesus perform miracles up to this point, and what I think is really important is where the story is going after this. The story of the calming of the storm, the story of the exorcism of the Gerasene demoniac, which is then followed by Jesus healing the woman with the issue of blood and raising Jairus' daughter. There is a theme established in these pericopes where fear and faith are set in opposition.
Yeah.
And you might say the interpretive moment comes when Jesus tells Jairus later, that's not in our text today, when he hears word that his daughter has died, Jesus says, "Me phobu, stop being afraid, only believe."
Huh.
And you've got the woman with the issue of blood who shows profound faith.
Right.
When she knows that just by touching Jesus, she can be saved. And the word there is sozo, saved, often translated healed.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know, therapuo was healed. And people say in this context, sozo means to be healed. But her problem was she had uncleanness
yeah.
that actually barred her from the temple, from
yeah.
coming to God in worship and from being a part of the community. And so she is more than healed. She is actually saved from that uncleanness.
Right.
And then you back up. You know, notice I'm starting at the end and backing up. And Jesus' great miracle in casting this legion of demons out of this man results in great fear.
Mm-hmm.
That whole area is afraid of Jesus, and they ask him to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see the disciples also afraid. And it's interesting, they're afraid when the storm starts, and They wake up Jesus, but they're afraid after he calms the storm.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Right.
That Jesus is kind of a terrifying, awesome guy. As you were making the point, I listened to you the previous hour, that these texts establish the lordship of Jesus, that he is the Son of God Most High, that he is God in the flesh. And God, it could be pretty scary. Even when he's doing these acts of salvation, it's terrifying.
Right, right. It confronts us with the reality that we're dealing with. And the only other piece I'd add to that, that's fantastic right there, is that we've seen in this last week, Jesus ends the Sermon on the Plain
right
by talking about hearing his word and keeping it, basically.
Yes.
And then you have a bunch of different versions of people hearing, from those who hear, get it, they know who he is, to those who kind of want to like him but aren't really sure, to those who, the Pharisees basically, are upset by what he's doing. And then he tells this parable yesterday about the word going out and the different types of crops, and then we immediately shift into fear, right? Like
right.
You would think he'd focus on stories about how you're bearing 100-fold fruit, and it doesn't quite happen that way. If anything, it starts to demonstrate how people still aren't getting who he really is.
Well, it's kind of interesting. Before this, you have his mother and brothers coming. And
right.
And he says, you know, who is my mother and my brothers? Those who hear the word of God and do it, right?
Right?
Are my mother and my brothers. And so the disciples are now in this special category of being Jesus' intimate family. And yet we see in the very next pericope how they still don't kind of get it all
yep.
the way yet.
Yep.
And this is another thing that ties these lessons together, is the disciples ask a question in the story of the calming of the storm that is not answered. It's answered actually by the demons in the next story.
Yeah. Huh.
Who then is this?
Yeah.
He commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him.
Yeah.
No answer. And then the demoniac comes in the very next story, and he's saying,
I
know who you are. Jesus, Jesus, Son of the Most High God. And we, the reader, then hopefully see the irony that we ought to know who this is.
Yeah.
And then just playing off of what you were saying, I was listening to you on the drive in. You know, just kind of this profound chaos,
uh-huh.
bigger than a storm on the sea, the chaos of sin, death, and Satan, that we should, in the midst of this life, we know who to trust.
Yeah.
You know? And
yeah.
So Jesus' question to the disciples is, where's your faith?
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Which also, I think, ultimately is teaching us, you know, how little we have our faith in the right thing.
Yes.
I don't want to go too far down that yeah. tangent, but there's... I think as a Christian, what I'm to learn is not, well, I need to get myself some more faith. It's
right.
more to realize that I need to be saved.
Right. And I think, yeah, faith is not a good work for us.
Yeah.
It is the result of the promises that God gives us. Those
yes.
promises elicit faith. And so faith is actually very inactive. It's simply receiving the gifts of God.
Right.
You know?
An empty sack, as Luther called it.
Yes.
You know?
And God makes a promise, and he made the promise. He's the one who made sure the promise would come to me in sending our Lord Jesus Christ, his Son, to be our Redeemer. And simply hearing the promise and believing it is no work at all. He's
right.
done everything. It's,
I was thinking about this the other day in another conversation I was having about how I can't make my wife trust me
right.
by telling her to, nor can she force herself to trust me. I must simply be trustworthy
right.
to her. And as I'm trustworthy to her, that engenders trust. It just,
right.
it just happens.
And that's, I mean, that's another way you can describe these lessons, is Jesus is faithful.
Yeah.
Calming the storm, casting out the demons, healing this woman, even though she like comes from behind, you know, he feels the power go out of him. And then finally, telling Jairus, stop being afraid, only believe, and then being faithful and raising his daughter up.
Mm.
And there is a sense in which you kind of wonder, I mean, it must have been hard to be a disciple. I mean, in other words, there's all these reasons to believe, and now suddenly our boat is being swamped with water,
yeah.
and we're in. And Luke makes it clear they were in danger.
Or there's all these reasons to believe, and then there he is dead.
Right, yeah.
You know?
Now, he told us he was going to rise again three times.
They didn't remember that, though.
Yeah,
I mean, they were lost.
And so I never like to beat up on the disciples,
because
I find myself identifying with them.
Amen.
But then you get this profound faith of this sinful woman back in the end of chapter 7, who would be one of the people who gets it.
Right.
You know, Simon the Pharisee doesn't get it. He didn't treat Jesus as an honored guest. This woman comes in, and she's a known sinner, nevertheless. And then you get this woman with the issue of blood. You get the man who is saved from the demons, who becomes, you might say in the Gospel of Luke, one of the proto-evangelists, one of the first.
Right. Well, I kind of want to hit that too. Yeah. There's so much in this text, God willing, we can get to it all. I'm going to go ahead and read through the first story, basically, and just kind of get it out there. One day, he got into a boat with his disciples. Again, Luke kind of has these, like, one day is then it happened things. I don't know if that means it's in order or not. I like to think Luke's a little more linear, but it may not be. But he's certainly putting these stories next to each other on purpose. But Jesus says to his disciples, let us go across to the other side of the lake. Okay, Jesus, you know, whatever. So they set out, and as they sailed, he fell asleep. And I guess in my own head, I'm asking, like, does he know what's going to happen? Is he doing this on purpose? Like, is this all set up here? And a windstorm, the squall, like you said earlier, came down on the lake. Massive storms coming off the Mediterranean. It makes the Sea of Galilee very dangerous for these fishing boats that they use over there. And they were filling with water and were in danger. He's sleeping. He's got some kind of divine power to sleep through storms, too, which I wish I had. And they went and they woke him saying, Master, Master, we are perishing, which at least they go to the right place. Do they believe he can do something? They seem surprised when he does. So maybe they just want to, like, you know, wake up and die with us kind of thing. He awoke or got up, little resurrection hint here as well, death and resurrection in the sleep and awake, and he rebuked, then the miracle's just insane. He rebukes the wind and the raging waves. What? And they ceased, and there was a calm. And I'm immediately drawn in my own head to the book of Revelation, where we see Christ on the throne of God, and before him is a sea of glass. I mean, there's no waves. Who can make the waves stop like that? But he does. And then he says to them, though, where is your faith? So again, this sort of a rebuke, really. And then, as you pointed out as well, the reaction of them to the miracle is fear. They were afraid and they marveled. So it isn't like they're going to jump out of the boat because they got to get away from Jesus. But they're totally confused, saying to one another, who is this? Question that, well said, is going to be answered by the demon, that he commands even winds and water, and they obey him. They is that hupakuo there? They underhear him. His words are above them.
Yeah? Right.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. And playing off what you were saying in the prior segment just about the chaos.
Yeah.
And the sea is a symbol of chaos. And this comes out of the Old Testament as well. And so who is, just to deal with that question, who is this? And you know, in the book of Genesis, you know, chapter 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, the earth was formless and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep.
Yeah.
And the Hebrew word there is the word Tiamat. And you were speaking earlier that this was sort of this goddess associated with darkness and chaos. I think I think that word is intentionally used in Genesis because here there is no goddess. This is simply stuff that God made.
Right.
But, you know, at the beginning of creation, everything was disorganized, and then, you know, and it says the Spirit of God was brooding upon the face of the waters, hovering upon it. And then out of this disorder, God creates order in the 6 days of creation.
Right.
Kind of dividing and forming. And out of this formless and void, you get something he declares as being very good. And so the symbol, the sea is a symbol of sort of the chaos of this fallen age.
Right.
And then Jesus here is demonstrating mastery over this, ownership of it. In our Greek text, they have a running concordance. Mm-hmm. And one of the passages cited is Psalm 65, where it says, you know, by awesome deeds you answer us with righteousness, O God of our salvation, the hope of all the ends of the earth and of the farthest seas, the one who by his strength established the mountains, being girded with might, who stills the roaring seas, the roaring of their waves and the tumult of the peoples. And I think with this psalm in mind, if the disciples knew this psalm, I imagine they did, they might have known the answer to their question.
Who can calm seas? The Bible in the Old Testament says God can't.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And so this is, Jesus has demonstrated his divine identity. I like this passage. I think it's his humanity and his divinity together. Mm. Who but true man could sleep through a storm?
Yeah.
You said it was maybe as part of his divine power.
Yes, I did, because I don't sleep well.
I know. But in Mark's account, this incident follows immediately upon the parabolic sermon. And in Luke, he has the incident of Jesus' mother and brothers in between. But in Mark's account, I imagine you as a pastor can identify with this Sunday after church. especially think after Easter Sunday with Lenten services, Maundy Thursday, Good Friday. If you've done something for Holy Saturday, then Easter, you're bushed. You could have
slept
launched a missile next to my head. I wouldn't have known.
Yeah.
And there he is, just dead asleep in the middle of this storm. And then he gets up. If I were to make the movie, he'd still be kind of groggy-eyed and just tells the wind and the waves to stop, and they do.
Right. Kind of the way that you send your kid to bed in the middle of the night. Like, go back to bed. Right,
right. And then I always wonder if Jesus just collapsed back in the boat and fell asleep again.
Because he's been with these great crowds that are pressing him everywhere. I didn't think about that. He's basically working constantly.
Yes.
So some of it's like, let's get in a boat and go across the water because I need a nap.
I need to get away from this.
Oh, my goodness.
I need a break.
That makes a ton of sense. I want to get back to the picture of chaos and him calming the storm, because there's a habit we have which is a little dangerous, which is to allegorize the historical stories of Jesus. And it's not that various authors don't actually do this on purpose. But we can go too far with it. We can end up denying the historicity in the first place of
it.
And we can also end up trying to fit too much into the story. And we'll run into this with the demoniac as well. But Chris asked from Twitter, in response to the "where is your faith" comment a little bit, he says, "Some say that with enough faith, we can calm the storms of our lives. Is that what the Lord means us to hear?" And even the phrase, as much as I would say this storm does represent the greater chaos of the fallen age, it's not talking about the storms of my personal life really at all.
Yeah, and that's a common way of allegorizing the story. And I've heard it preached in Lutheran pulpits and in others. That Jesus calms the storms of our lives. The question of the disciples shows this is primarily about the identity of Jesus.
Yes.
And the next passage also, again, about the identity of Jesus. The question is asked and then answered. And so this is, Jesus is the Son of the Most High God. He is God the Son in human flesh, doing what God does, calming the storm. And then if you were to kind of read this with the Old Testament, what the sea represents in the Psalms is a sort of chaos that he can calm, that he's master of this. And I don't think God created the world to be a place where there'd be storms and hurricanes like this.
Right.
That's a result of the fall into sin. And in Revelation, there's going to be no sea at all. The new heavens, new
goes
earth.
Away.
I hope there's water. I mean, there's going to be the river of life. I like to swim. But this the idea of this kind of raging chaos, you might say, I'd say this is kind of proleptic of the last day when that chaos is going to be solved. And then your reading of Revelation, that kind of sea of glass is, Jesus. So if you want to go anywhere with this beyond simply on that day, he historically calmed the storm and showed at least us, the reader, who he is. The disciples didn't quite know. This is what he came to do is he came to war against the realm of Satan, the realm of chaos, the realm of death, the realm of sin. And we're going to see him actually at the end of this section raise somebody up from the dead. And then we're going to go on to chapter 9 where he's going to raise another guy up from the dead. And then eventually he himself is going to die
and rise. So if you can conceive of the phrase, the storms of your life, as referring to sin, death, and the power of the devil,
Right.
But it's not about my momentary struggles, even though the chaos of this age certainly is part of that.
Yes.
He's not going to fix it all tomorrow. Just having enough faith isn't going to make my life a peaceful sea right now.
Right. And the disciples would all experience this later in Acts. They're thrown into prison. They're whipped. James, the son of Zebedee, is killed. Yeah. Stephen is stoned to death. It wasn't because they didn't have enough faith. That actually happened because they were faithful.
Right.
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 And so, ironically, being faithful might lead you to have storms in this life.
Yeah.
But don't allegorize this lesson. If you're going to go anywhere with it, it really is Jesus sort of calming this storm historically and then in his ministry basically warring against sin, death, and the devil. Yeah, which is our greater problem.
Yeah, amen. Yeah. My guest, Dr. David Lewis of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, talking about Luke chapter 8. There's so much there. We've got a man with a demon coming up next. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Mark Hawkinson with an invitation for you to join me over the weekday noon hour for Moments of Assurance, your lunchtime spiritual recipe. You'll enjoy encouraging scriptures, A bit of Bible history and trivia, news items, humor, the kids' corner, and more, all mixed in with faith-strengthening sacred music. A blend just right for your midday hour. So join me, won't you? That's Moments of Assurance over the weekday noontime hour here on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Hi, I found a toy dinosaur over on the playground by Smith Street. It had this phone number on it, and, well, I just wanted to make sure the dinosaur made it back to its little owner.
When I found the little sippy cup, I just had to give you a call. It's for a kid, you know?
I know my son gets super attached to the smallest things, even a fire truck, and I'd be happy to drop it off.
We do anything for kids, yet 1 in 6 children in the U.S. struggle with hunger. Help end childhood hunger. Contact St. Louis Area Food Bank, brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to His Time on Worldwide KFUO, digging into the battle between the Lord God Almighty and Tiamat, ancient dragon, Lord of Chaos. Not exactly, but kind of what's happening as Jesus fights against the storm, literally and truly, the chaos of sin, death, and the devil. And then some more, just in case you're wondering where we get this idea he's fighting against demons. When he gets off the boat, well, there's one there to meet him. So picking up then at verse 26, as much as I'd love to stick around that text before, then they sailed, so after the storm, they sailed to the country of the Gerasenes, which is opposite Galilee. When Jesus stepped out on land, there met him a man from the city who had demons. Did he know he was coming? Hard to say. Certainly he's living outside the city. We know he's going to say he dwells in tombs, but why is he down by the water? For a long time, though, Luke just describes him, how bizarre a man he is, how tormented, I should say, he is. For a long time, he had worn no clothes. So you got to figure this guy's, he's buck naked. He can't look healthy in any way, shape, or form. He had not lived in a house, but among the tombs. So he's sleeping in the graveyards or the caves. When he saw Jesus, he answers the question, as you pointed out, Dr. Lewis, earlier, that the disciples asked, who is this man? He cried out and fell down before him, something everyone else should be doing, and said with a loud voice, what have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? Which it's really a literal question. Like, why are you here? What is your purpose in this? I beg you, do not torment me. But he calls Jesus not just Son of God, Son of the Most High God. That's interesting, too. It's a bit of a shift. We get from Luke here, this wasn't in Mark when we looked at this before, that Jesus says something to him first. So when Jesus sees him, he seems to know what's going on, and he had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man, which this is interesting too. So Jesus actually says, come out of him, and he doesn't. So he's got a little resistance going on, which is really interesting. And now Luke goes back to describing the problem. Many a time it had seized the man. He was kept under guard and bound with chains and shackles, but he would break the bonds and be driven by the demon into the desert. People these days, they want to find all sorts of miracles, and they think if they find one, therefore it means that God is present. But the demons, I mean, they had superpowers. He's breaking shackles of iron here. We know that they lead a slave girl at one point to tell the future. So this is just one of those points to notice. Demon possession is real. It's dangerous, but real in that it can impact this world. And Jesus has a question for him, which I got to connect to the fact that the guy's resisting him. So it's like, you know, Jesus says, come out of him. And the guy's like, what do you have to do with me? And so Jesus is like, excuse me? Who are you? what is your name? And he says, Legion, for many demons had entered him. So he's dealing with an army of demons, really. And they begged him, these demons again, they are submissive. They begged him not to command them to depart into the abuso, the abyss, which is connected to that chaos of the sea from before as well. Dr. Lewis, take it away.
And I think that connection is made clear where the story ends for the demons, where they end up.
Yeah.
We'll get there in a second. But I think we are to see a connection between the raging sea and now these demonic forces. I think people who read the Old Testament would see that connection with the sea representing sort of the chaos of this fallen age, you know, Tiamat, which again in Genesis 1 verse 2 is not this demon dragon goddess. It's simply stuff, right? And that's kind of like the Genesis way of the sun and the moon are simply greater light, lesser light. They're not gods. They're just things that God made.
What I love about old language like that, though, because I think it reveals our idolatry, these things weren't names that were given to things. They were the word for what the thing was.
Right.
Right? And so when you would say, I mean, it doesn't quite work for Zeus, but when you're worshiping Tiamat, you're taking the word for sea and you're saying the sea is a god.
Right.
And it's not like for us where names aren't really the thing themselves.
Right. But that seems to be what was happening in the days of the Old Testament.
Yeah, for sure.
And so it's interesting, God Most High, you know, why not just God? This seems to be Gentile area. They got pigs. This was once a part of the land of Israel. You know, the right. Three eastern tribes on the other side of the Jordan possessed this. But now this is the area where the Decapolis was. This was, you know, settled by Gentiles. That's why you have these pigs being raised. And you know, God Most High is like El Shaddai, you know, in the book of Genesis, sort of who he is to Israel is Yahweh Elohim,
right,
the Lord God, but who he is to the nations is God Most High.
Huh.
And the demons are sort of speaking as if they're not Israelites, because
right.
they're not.
Yeah, yeah.
And but they recognize who Jesus is. And so the question asked by the disciples, who then is this, who has this kind of authority? These guys, these demons recognize the authority. And so even though they're fighting, this is a battle.
Yeah.
They're fighting him. They however, know that he's got the authority to do this.
Right.
Which is why they make this odd request. They don't want to go to the abyss. They know that it's like they know judgment is coming.
Right.
But they don't want to experience that judgment. They kind of think Jesus is here bringing that eschatological judgment
yes,
now
exactly.
to them. They don't want it. They want it delayed. And so they make this weird request to go into the swine instead. And it shows kind of how evil and hypocritical Satan is. These demons have been torturing this guy, as you mentioned before, but they themselves don't want to be tortured.
They want some mercy. Which
it's weird. They're begging for, and their mercy is simply, you might say, a temporary stay in eschatological judgment, you know, which they kind of know is coming.
That's
you know?
A really valuable point, though, that because we do this too. Like, we want to self-justify ourselves, but we don't want anybody else to do it, right?
Right.
We want people to be nice to us, but when someone goes against me, well, you know, I'm gonna take it out on them. And then with that, and so it's a different thought in a sense. It's interesting that they do appeal to the one thing that you can appeal to Yahweh Elohim for, and he always wants to give, which is mercy.
Right.
Like, they almost
yeah.
it's like they know who he is.
Right. And notice that's how Yahweh describes himself to Moses in Exodus 33 and 34. He's full of amat and kesed, true, you know, great kesed and amat, you know, that covenant faithfulness you were mm-hmm. talking about before, and truth, that what he says he's going to do. He's even if Israel breaks the covenant like they did with the golden calf, he's going to remain faithful. And so it is interesting the demons are looking to Yahweh for what they know he does.
Yeah.
Give his
yeah.
defining characteristic is he's full of kesed. You know, he's a merciful God.
And his mercy upon the man
right.
is to, the demons don't really get mercy.
They don't,
to
right.
drive them into the abyss that they don't want to go into.
Yeah, that's where the story
okay,
goes.
So let's read the story. It's so cool. Verse 32. Now a large herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside. They begged him to let them enter these so that he gave them permission. Then the demons came out of the man and entered the pigs, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and drowned. When the herdsmen saw what had happened, so there's locals who are taking care of these pigs, they fled and told it in the city and in the country. So everyone runs out to see it. Then the people went out to see what had happened, and they came to Jesus and found the man from whom the demons had gone, sitting at Jesus' feet, clothed in his right mind, and they were afraid. I mean, this is a miracle of the highest order, really, to take this man who we would have put him in an insane asylum of some kind here. We would have put him chained up, just like they were doing to him. And here he is in his right mind again. And those who had seen it told them how the demon-possessed man had been healed. Then all of the people of the surrounding country of the Gerasenes asked him to depart from them, for they were seized with great fear, which is not faith. And I have to see in this, if we're going to do this a little bit as the storm, death and resurrection, calming of the chaos by binding the strong man of the devil, there's a little bit of a proleptic piece where the response of the world to Jesus' resurrection is very similar to their response here. The response of the Hebrews, you mentioned earlier, Peter and the apostles being persecuted, not so entirely different. And then you have this other piece. I want to just read it so that we can spend the last minutes talking about everything. The man from whom the demons had gone out begged that he might be with him, Jesus. But Jesus sent him away, and it's hard to see this in the Greek, but Jesus apostled him away. There's two different ways to say sent in the Greek, and I don't want to read too much into this, but the fact that it's the word apostle and not the word pempo, it's at least got a little foreshadow going on here. Return to your home, he says, and he actually commissions him. Preach, right? Declare how much God has done for you. which some people take to mean, therefore, when we tell others about Christ, we have to give our life story. I don't know if that's quite what's going on here. And he went away proclaiming, is that Caruso?
Yeah, it is Caruso.
Oh, man, so it's another preaching word.
Yeah.
Throughout the whole city, how much Jesus had done for him. So he goes and he preaches Christ.
And you notice that kind of interesting segue that you see in Luke is Jesus' command is, you go declare.
Right.
You know, how much God has done for you.
Right.
And then the guy goes and he preaches what Jesus has done for him.
That's good.
And so if you think first of the identity of Jesus, this is God in the flesh right here.
Yeah.
But also, if you want to talk about God the Father, if you want to talk about what God has done today, post the incarnation, then you talk about what Jesus has done.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
There is no place God is working where he's not working through his son. No place where he's speaking where he's not speaking through his son.
And this is where what God has done for you, what Jesus has done for you,
right,
is not necessarily what he's done in the temporal moment. It's,
right,
it's this death and resurrection thing.
Yeah. And for this guy, it's that he saved him from demonic possession.
Right.
And you'd mentioned, we were talking about mercy before, just kind of the lack of mercy in the people in the area. They see this guy saved, and rather than being
glad,
overwhelmed by the mercy that Jesus has shown for this neighbor of theirs, they're afraid and send Jesus away. But it's interesting how Jesus is still merciful to them,
right? Right.
Because rather than take this guy along, he sends him back to proclaim the gospel to them. And so his response to their fear in sending him away is not to disown these people and say, you guys are without a hope. This was your chance, go to hell. But he actually commissions this guy to be his witness. And so Jesus goes to those very people who just told Jesus, they begged Jesus to leave, just like the demons begged. And Jesus listens, but he leaves this guy back as the proclaimer of the gospel.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, like, we can try to turn our back on the mercy of God, but he just gives more mercy.
Right.
You can still not believe, ultimately, but he doesn't stop sending that promise. That was in the confessions reading earlier this morning about election, that he earnestly desires all people to be saved.
Yes.
And it's a deep will of his. Getting back to the pigs, though, how weird is this story just in weird.
And I think the weirdness of the story is one of the elements that attest to its historicity.
What do you mean? Like, unpack that.
In other words, this story is so weird, nobody would have made this up.
Yes.
It happened.
Yeah.
I remember once in chapel, the reading was from Numbers about where the people wanted meat, and Yahweh and Moses have this interaction where Yahweh says, I'm going to give them so much will be coming out their nose. And Moses, really sarcastic, what, are we going to kill all the cattle? You're going to dry up the sea so we can get fish? And Yahweh responds, like, when did my hand shorten?
Yeah.
Right? When did I stop being God? And Jim Veltz was sitting at, Dr. James Veltz was sitting in the pew in front of me. He turns around and looks at me. He says, Dave, this stuff is so weird. Nobody's going to make this up. It had to have happened,
that's
right?
Exactly,
if you're going to make
up
a story about Moses and God, it's not going to have this stuff. And this thing about the pigs, and you read the interpretation of this, people are like, do the pigs represent uncleanness?
Right.
The pigs represent the fact that this is Gentile land, in what should be Israel. The demons identify themselves as legion, which symbolizes the Roman occupation. They try to come up with all these explanations for what's going on. That could be good. But in the end, I just think this is what happened.
Right.
In other words, as weird as it is, the demons wanted to go into the pigs, and Jesus let them.
Right.
And then the pigs commit suicide. And that, why? Do the demons drive them into the abyss, or do the pigs have enough sense that they don't want to be possessed, that they kill themselves?
Right.
But then, ironically, the demons don't want to go into the abyss, but the sea, which is a symbol of the abyss, is where they end up anyway.
Right, right. So at the very least, we have to get that much, right?
Right.
They don't want to go, and this is in the language, caught up in the language of Greek a little bit. It doesn't come off in the English, but the abyss is the way to say the sea, abuso, like literally.
Right, abuso,
and so when they say don't drive us, but it's also this language of the sort of holding place for the demonic powers until the day of judgment. I mean, this isn't hell, right? This isn't the fiery end.
Yeah, no one's in the lake of fire yet until we get to Revelation chapter 20,
right?
The last judgment. So this seems to be, the abyss seems to be this place where the demonic realm are held in prison until that eschatological judgment comes. In Mark's account, it actually says they didn't want to leave that land.
Huh.
This kind of weird idea that demons like find places where it's cool to be a demon. We can hang out here,
right,
in this Gentile area where there's not a fear of the God of Israel and people are raising pigs.
Right.
And they don't want to leave the land, and yet they end up leaving the land. They go into the sea.
Huh.
And then here they actually ask not to go into the abyss, and they end up in the abyss.
Right. And
could it be kind of Jesus knew what was going to happen? But then the whole thing, like, why does he honor their request?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you can give an answer. What I see in this, though, is this stuff is just so weird. I don't think anybody made this up.
No.
I think the apostles told, this is what happened.
Yeah.
You know, they asked to go into the pigs, and he sent them into the pigs, and the pigs ran down the cliff and drowned themselves. And it's like, whoa. And what? And you try to ask, like, what does all this mean? Just one thing I like to say is I think this actually happened.
Yeah.
The way the story is told just attests to its historicity. There's no... If people make stuff up, it's going to be a clean story. And it's not going to be this weird. This is just a weird...
Yeah, if you read real mythology, everything lines up pretty perfectly.
I mean, right.
There aren't accidents. And here it is. I will say, I mean, there's this thing, and I think I got this from Tolkien, but I think it's biblical as well. Oh, do we have a... Looks like we got a call. Oh, I want to take that. I think it's biblical as well, which is that all the evil that the wicked world tries to do, God allows it, and then he bends it to his own purpose. So what they're trying to do as evil things to save themselves ends up being their undoing. He catches the wise in their own conceits,
kind of the,
right?
That's kind of the irony of this passage, yeah.
Let's say hello to Dan. We just got a few minutes left here. Dan, you're calling from, I can't see it on the screen, Beloit, Wisconsin, with a question for Dr. Lewis and myself. Please go ahead, Dan. Good morning.
Yes. Didn't Jesus return to this same area sometime later? And he had a lot of people there waiting for him, as opposed to
Dr. Lewis.
Get out of town, you're bothering us.
Okay. Actually, it kind of an interesting feature of Luke's narrative. In Matthew and Mark, the same story is told. And when Jesus goes back to the Decapolis, there's a great crowd, which then precipitates the miracle of the feeding of the 4,000.
Mm.
Right. And so I would tend, reading in a narrative way, what. The fact that this demoniac is proclaiming the gospel to these people creates interest that when Jesus comes back, there is interest in him.
Yeah.
Luke edits those stories out of his narrative. You don't have the feeding of the 4,000. You don't have the casting out of the demon from the Syrophoenician woman in Luke. And people wonder why. You know, why does Luke leave this stuff out? My own educated guess, is that Luke plans to write a book called Acts of the Apostles.
That's right.
Where you're going to see the church go to the Gentiles. And Matthew and Mark, they don't have Acts of the Apostles, so you have Gentile ministry that Jesus actually did described in their Gospels to know that Gentiles are also included in the ministry of Jesus. Luke, I think, is saving that, you know, kind of saving that story for the book of Acts. But we know from Matthew and Mark that when Jesus goes back to this area, there are crowds that are interested in him, and the miracle of the feeding of the 4,000 takes place. Likely an audience of mixed Jews and Gentiles are fed. Feeding of the 5,000 is told in Luke. That's to Israel. That's to Jews on the other side of Galilee, where, you know, the right side of Galilee, you might say, the Israel side. And then the feeding of the 4,000 takes place in the area of the Decapolis. And my reading is Luke, for whatever reason, well, I think he decides not to tell of Jesus' Gentile ministry other than this story in his narrative because he's saving that for the book of Acts.
Thank you for the question, Dan. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
As my guest, Dr. David Lewis. He is an exegetical professor over there at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, teaching young pastors to be, to read the Bible rightly. And you can tell by what he did today that he does a decent job of getting at the meaning of the text. Dr. Lewis, thank you for being with us this morning.
It's great to be with you as always. Yeah.
Jesus is not going to calm the storm of your hangnail, but he is going to put an end to your grave. And like I said, that ancient demon, which has basically become to us a god, because of our submission to him so that all creation is at his whim, is not at his whim any longer, especially your own death, your own body being put into that grave. Christ is risen from the dead, and this is the gospel of who he is and what he has done for you. You're listening to His Time, Worldwide KFUO, Creation Club, Worldview Watch, coming up next. Stick around.